Thank you, Brandon. Okay, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the organizing committee for having me. Let's see. So I see some Texas people out here, so that'll be good. Okay, I won't have any Texas jokes then. Okay. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm probably going to talk more indirectly about losses in that we want to preserve nitrogen in the system, and that's what I'm really going to talk about. So animal manure sources come from a variety of places, right? We have beef cattle on feedlots. We have dairy that are often confined also, but the liquid is applied to the land. And then we have the chickens that are housed, and we spread litter out there, typically in the southeastern U.S., and then we have swine throughout the country, and, of course, a liquid source as well. And so we have manure issues that we have to deal with, either through that confinement or directly on the land. And the idea about nutrient management in manures is complicated because the nutrient composition is not so straightforward. You see here the distribution of dry matter, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And these are the key elements that we often look for. Of course, we have some trace elements that are important and some contaminants in these manures, too, that were of concern. But the source of that manure is important, and you see some variations, such as with chicken litter, we have a higher dry matter percentage than beef or dairy. And these are some variations that are important. We also have this distribution among these different sources, more typically in like phosphorus, and then these variations can vary anywhere from 2 to 3-fold, something like that. But we also have different places, and so we have two different sources here. One is from Wisconsin, one from Indiana and Purdue, and we see that there are actually some differences. The dry matter in at least reported in Wisconsin is within the range reported at Purdue, but there's quite a large range in the dry matter percentage. And then we have some that are on the low end or the high end, and so source of that manure is important and how we actually define that, and then it leads to how do we make recommendations on the actual application rate. We have others that are at the low end or even outside of the range of other places, and then we see that we have some that are well within. In this graph here on the bottom, this is taken from various manures in California. And it just shows that there's quite a large range of total nitrogen that can be present. So we do have to actually make measurements. It's not necessarily sufficient just to use book values in many cases, because in this case here, anywhere from 1 to 3.5% nitrogen could be available in that manure, and how we actually make a recommendation is important then. From a specific example, from a very specific field study where we conducted a study for 12 years, we had three application rates of poultry litter to this pasture study. I just wanted to show you that there are some variations even within this one study to show you that there's variation in moisture content, in carbon content. These are box and whisker plots where actually we see the range, the typical range that we have. And then, of course, we get into the elements that are of lower concentration, like nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and calcium, but we see a large range. This is over the average of 12 years, and it's probably from roughly 24 or so different applications. And so we have some variation. It's all from the same litter provider. But obviously there are some variations in the production of the animals themselves. And then varying even with minor elements, and then to the very lower end into ppm range, the variations that can occur due to iron or aluminum based on whether there's any soil contaminants or if there's actually an amendment to stop some of the phosphorus loss that might occur. So the common approach is to characterize nutrient or manure through nutrient availability in the composition that I've shown to you, the application rate, which is the actual tons per hectare that might be applied to the field, and then the fraction available. And these numbers are a fraction of, say, anywhere from 0 to 1 or 0 to 100%. And so that number can vary a lot, too. And so the major issues with each of these components would be that consistency of that composition is important. We know that there are some variations that occur. The uniformity of application rate can be quite serious in some cases. This is real world. These are application systems where the lines of application may not be uniform. They may overlap. They may oftentimes, at least what we found was that the chicken litter was being spread around shade and water sources, maybe preferentially, and that's where we actually need to avoid nutrient application because there's preferential deposition of nutrients there. And then the fraction of it that's available, the weather largely controls that, whether it's dry or wet. and whether the time of the year that it's being applied. So an alternative is to look at soil testing and how we can actually look at manure or nutrient availability in manures just from soil testing. So we often measure with depth. We take cores and we section various depths, but typically it would be 0 to 10 centimeters, 10 to 20, and 20 to 30. Because we know that the application is mostly at the surface, we're looking at conservation systems, no tillage in cropland and pastures, which are not usually disturbed. And so we're looking at that depth distribution. And we do need to know about the routine soil testing. This is just to show you that this is an example from North Carolina Department of Agriculture, that you'll get the suite of nutrients that are important, the pH, the acidity, the macronutrients, and the micronutrients. And that's important because we need to know about the concentration in the soil, the native condition, as well as that condition as ameliorated with manures. So the concern is of course with soil testing is that about phosphorus with manures, right? But it depends on how that land is then managed. In this case here, if we have fertilized with inorganic sources, we do see a change with time, the blue diagram there. And then it depends with the litter, we have an increase depending whether we harvest that material or graze it, and how we harvest it, so as for hay or if it's grazed. So that'll depend on how the accumulation of phosphorus might occur. And then at least in our soils in the southeastern U.S., we have kaolinitic clays, and so there's a high fixation of that phosphorus. And so we see that accumulation at the very surface, but very little depth movement. Now, if we had pure sands, we could see some movement of that. And so that's one value of the soil testing approach, is that we understand that actually there will be some changes that occur over time. So the biological testing for nutrients is really focused on this fractionation scheme. We try to use a more functional fractionation scheme, not necessarily the classic hydrolysis, but we have a total pool of nitrogen. We have a particulate pool of nitrogen, which turns over relatively, at least in a decadal time period. And then we have these active fractions, and we're trying to characterize these active fractions to get at how manures can be used as a resource rather than as waste. And our approach is to use incubation, to use the biological occurrence that occurs in soil where nutrients are mineralized through time. And see, this just shows that we have a jar that with soil in it, we're trapping the CO2, and we're also looking at nitrogen mineralization. And this consistency with time is what's important, is that we have this occurrence where we have a flush of activity and then we have stabilization. We're also looking at the ability to actually utilize a growth study so that we can actually see the nitrogen that might be mineralized by this. And so we're looking at unamended soil in greenhouse trials. We're planting a sorghum Sudan grass crop as a test crop, and then just finding out what is the potential during a 8-week period of what grows in these soils. I wanted to show you some of those results from this greenhouse trial because I thought they were pretty interesting in that plant dry matter production is a function. This is growth in the greenhouse under semi-controlled conditions, temperature and water are controlled. And then we have residual inorganic nitrogen. If we don't have a history of poultry litter, there's essentially no real relationship with inorganic nitrogen. It's variable. It's such a fraction that changes with time, with space. And so the residual inorganic nitrogen doesn't help much. But if we add to that the residual inorganic nitrogen plus nitrogen mineralization, then we see a stronger relationship. We all of a sudden can account for 83% of the variability in plant dry matter production. And that's with no history of broiler litter. If we have a history of broiler litter, the interesting fact is that residual inorganic nitrogen actually is very helpful. And this is not just in this case, but it often is the case. Because we're applying this manure, it's being mineralized, but there's some left over because almost always we have an organic source that's mineralizing over time. And we're always going to have a little bit of residual that's occurring during the non-growing season. So the inorganic nitrogen does contribute, but if we add again the nitrogen mineralization potential, then we see a much stronger relationship. And in this case, we can explain 95% of the variability. With a higher rate of broiler litter, then this is just a historical on a field that over the past 5 years had received some rates of poultry litter. We see that the inorganic nitrogen is important here in this case, again, also, but then the history of the nitrogen mineralization, adding that to it, strengthens the relationship. We put all three of these different soil conditions together, and we see a nice relationship that occurs. Now, there were unique characteristics of each field, but overall, the nitrogen mineralization is important. We also saw that in the lower left here that there were variations in the residual inorganic nitrogen. That shows the mean and the standard deviation to show you that adding historical levels of poultry litter will lead to different levels of residual inorganic nitrogen. This happened to be in a corn cropping system on sandy soils. But the point being that the net nitrogen mineralization was very key. It explained 83% of the variation. But if we added residual inorganic nitrogen, it only improved the relationship by 3%. So it made it up to 86%. So it is important, and we can measure it. And oftentimes we have measured it, and we attribute it to residual inorganic nitrogen. But we really ought to be attributing it to nitrogen mineralization. So the plant dry matter production, in this case here, I've got nitrogen mineralization. So I want to bring you to the point that we're hypothesizing we can use something other than nitrogen mineralization because it takes time in the laboratory to do that. So we're looking at the flush of CO2 that's produced. Carbon and nitrogen are intimately linked, and we can use a short-term carbon mineralization assay to get at nitrogen mineralization. It's not the same thing, but it mimics the same process. And so here we see the same data as related to the flush of CO2 and a very strong relationship. But I point to this one value up on top there. In that case, there was a value where there was residual inorganic nitrogen of 98 parts per million. So obviously a large source of immediately available nitrogen that created this higher plant dry matter production, but which we were not able to predict so directly and so closely with the flush of CO2. So residual inorganic nitrogen still important in this case. So why do we measure the flush of CO2? So we have soils that are incubated, and we can discern differences among different types of soils. The derivation of that cumulative curve, it leads to the instantaneous rates that occur on the lower curve. And the point being that if we are interested in this point here of several weeks after mineralization, we want to get at those differences in the rates that occur with time. Because when we dry the soil, it's an artifact. It doesn't necessarily occur completely in the field like that. But the point being that the rates that occur later in the incubation are also reflected as well in the early part of the incubation. The values are different, but they're very strongly related. So the approach is simple, rapid, and reliable. And Heidi is already standing up, so I am going to look at why the flush of CO2 is sensitive. And in this case, it's sensitive to a long-term study where we had different stocking rates of cattle, so obviously different manure distribution that's occurring. And so we had an optimization that occurred. It shows the depth effect. The shallower the depth, the more responsive it would be. But it also shows, in this case, the yearly change of the flush of CO2. All of the values were changing with time. This is just the yearly change that occurred. And so it does show that the change in time occurred. But it also reflects the change in soil organic carbon that was occurring. So this flush of CO2 is sensitive to both stocking rate and depth distribution. It's also sensitive to the type and rate of application of manures. In this case, the first three bars are with broiler litter at three different rates and with no grazing. We basically had a hay harvest or a CRP. And the last three bars are with grazing and different rates of poultry litter. And we see that the effect of the grazing is picked up in the soil testing, as well as the rate of application of the manure. And then with a little bit lower depth, we see the same kinds of trends, other than that the values are subdued, the treatment differences are subdued. We see an increase in the flush of CO2 with the rate of application of poultry litter, and then we don't see this grazing, this manure from the cattle, the grazing effect in the lower depth as we do at the surface depth. We also think that it's sensitive to corn and tall fescue and wheat production. We see that the level of nitrogen provided by these systems without additional nitrogen fertilizer at the beginning of the year is related to the flush of CO2. Low levels of flush of CO2 lead to low levels of production, and high levels lead to adequate levels of production. And this takes some of the data that we have from specific cases where we have the gray symbols, which are farms without manure inputs, where we don't have this organic source that's being applied, and the red symbols, those that with organic inputs. And so the levels of the flush of CO2 are elevated with manure inputs. That's the first fact. But the yield efficiency, how efficient is the nitrogen application rate during the growing season? If there's a high value, then there's a high response to nitrogen fertilizer. If there's a low value, that means that nitrogen wasn't needed in the system. We had the low yield efficiency. You apply 100 kilograms and get no additional yield. So this shows that clearly that manures are important in changing that relationship. Okay, to summarize, nutrient availability from animal manures is variable. Certainly the species and the type of feedstuffs are important. The storage and handling are important. So we have to know all these things. And if we can make book values out of these, of course, that's good. And we have a lot of these all around the country, but there are variations that occur in this too. And farmers, you know, may or may not follow those recommendations, so we have to deal with that. And of course, weather and the season and the landscape distribution are important. The other thing is that lab incubation is a soil-specific approach to assess nitrogen availability, and certainly in a long-term approach, we've shown this, as well, if it works on a short-term basis, we're probably not as well in tune with this yet, but further testing will be needed. And certainly we believe that the flush of CO2 is simple, it's rapid, it's reliable, and it really does show a reflection of the manure inputs, and so in the long-term, it's something that we should look at. So thanks very much. Yes, Shabtai.
Thanks, Alan. That was really interesting. The testing that you did, does this reflect the current manure application or historical or a combination?
It's more so the question is whether it's current or if it's historical. And it would be a combination, certainly. We probably cannot discern, unless we were able to test, say, only historical application with no current application versus historical plus current application. I think that's the only way we could do that, but it's really a historical level. Yes. Yes, Nancy? Yes, the question is whether the CO2 flush is on air-dried soil. Actually, we oven-dry the soil, but it can be air-dried as well. And in this case, you don't have to necessarily air-dry it, but for the test to work and to be a real protocol, it does need to be. Because if you use field moist soil, you don't get this flush. You get more of a steady state level. And that the reason why we want to have the flush is because we can get a greater response early on rather than wait. Otherwise, we'd have to wait several days. We wouldn't be sensitive enough to measure it. Question in the back. Yes, I can't see.
Is that flush, is it related to the microbial biomass? Have you looked at that at all?
Right. Thanks for the question. Whether it's the flush is related to microbial biomass. Yes, only through association of the data. Yes, it's very closely related to microbial biomass. Yes.
Alan, I have a question.
Yes, Monte.
You know, we major activity at certain depths and rates and things like that. But then there's always someone or a group or an organization that wants to hold us accountable for what we've done. As in the case of applying manures and phosphorus levels. Mm-hmm. So from your data, what if you had to recommend a soil depth mm-hmm. from which we are held accountable, what soil depth would you say we would produce a certain level of perturbation of phosphorus in an accountability? Let's just take water.
Right. Okay. Great question. And I'm going to paraphrase your question because I'm not sure I can. And I don't want to repeat everything about the regulations, right? Okay. Okay. So the question is what depth would be most appropriate to sample, right? In general.
When we're held accountable.
If we're held accountable. Right. Yeah. Well, of course, the greater the depth, the more information you'll get. But actually, in this case, if we take only one depth and we take too deep of a depth, we're diluting what happens at the very surface with all this activity that really doesn't occur to a much greater extent with depth. And so that dilution is really important. Then all of a sudden we're less sensitive in detecting differences. So I would say that the best recommendation I think that we can make is that we're looking at 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, and we do this because we do want to know what depth is most appropriate. But the 20 to 30 and the 10 to 20 centimeter depths don't really contribute a whole lot, in at least in manured soils, that the 0 to 10 centimeter is the most appropriate, whether it's tilled or not, because the tillage, of course, would stir it up, and you're going to see it in 0 to 10 as well as 20 to 30. But in no-till soils or conservation agricultural systems, we do need to focus on the 0 to 10 cents.